This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good evening. As you know, my name's Richard Hecht. I am professor of religious studies and the chair of the program committee of the Taubman Symposia in Jewish Studies. I join with my colleague Leonard Wallach in welcoming all of you and hope that we will see you in many other events in the future. And let me tell you that tonight we're going to have in for a very exciting discussion with Ari Shavit. Before we turn to my formal introduction of him, let me just point out two things. First of all, this presentation, and indeed the campus visit of Ari Shavit, is co-presented by the Taubman Symposia in Jewish Studies and also Hillel International. In your program, you will find yellow cards, and those are for you to write questions. You can begin writing those questions during his presentation or afterwards. And if you pass them to your left, our student colleagues will pick them up and they will deliver them to me, and I will find the best and most interesting questions and ask those for you. We have all come here tonight in large part because Ari Shavit's extraordinary book, My Promised Land, The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel. Earlier today, Ari Shavit joined my class, and I asked him about the genesis of this extraordinary book. And in response to that question, he told us that one of the reasons he took up the writing of this book was to find the narratives that Israel, he believes, has lost. This is a deep and profound meditation, told in part through his family history and in the voices of many Israelis, some colleagues, some friends, and some who reflect the landscape of that narrative. He writes about his book at the very end. He says, "It's all about people. The book I have written is the story of Israel as it is seen by individual Israelis, of whom I am one. Indeed, it is a narrative which complicates everything about Israel, and as such, it has earned countless admirers as well as a few critics. But it is very much a story of the human adventure of Israel. As such, it is a book that is necessary at this time, as necessary as earlier efforts such as Amos Elon's, the Israelis founders and sons, written nearly 40 years ago, or Amos Oz's Here and There in the Land of Israel, written almost 30 years ago. And it is a book written beautifully and with absolute integrity. Let me share a few sentences drawn from his conclusion to a chapter in which he describes Muhammad Dalal and his journey through the Galilee. Muhammad Dalal is a Palestinian Israeli attorney and took him into the world of the Galilee to understand the reality, what makes the lives of Palestinian Israelis like himself. Ari Shavit writes of Dalal, "He is smart and engaged and full of life. He is direct, warm, devilishly talented. Had he wished to, by now he would have been a judge or a member of parliament or a mayor or one of the leaders of Israel's Palestinian community. He is as Israeli as any Israeli I know. He is one of the sharpest friends I have. We share a city, a state, and a homeland. We hold in common values and beliefs. And yet there is a terrible schism between us. What will become of us, Muhammad? I wonder in the dark, what will become of my daughter, Tamara, and your son, Omar? What will happen to my land and your land?" Please now welcome Ari Shavit.
Wow. I didn't believe you'd make it in the rain. I'm so happy and privileged and feel humbled to be here today. I came a long way. I brought with me the rain from London. But I'm so happy I did this journey because it was important for me to come to this great university and to address you people. I will try to do the impossible in the next 30, 40 minutes, to talk a bit about my book, a bit about my country, and then about the challenges facing both America and Israel in the new violent Middle East. So I hope we'll manage to do all this, but I'm especially looking forward to the conversation we'll have later, and I'm so eager to hear your questions, your remarks, because I think that it's so needed to have a candid, intelligent, civilized discussion about Israel, about the Middle East, and about American-Israeli relationship. I wrote my book, as it was said, because I had a feeling, a notion, that we Israelis have lost our narrative. But not only we did, I think that many people who love Israel, but also many people who criticize Israel viciously, have lost sight of the larger picture, of the larger context, of the sense of what Israel is all about. So what I did in my book is to ask myself three questions that in my mind are the Israel questions. Why Israel? What's Israel? And will Israel? But I did not try to answer these questions with a theory, with a thesis. I did not want to write another book of polemics. We have so much polemics regarding that nation. And I do my own polemics in my paper, in television, in American papers. The book was not about that. I tried to answer these questions by telling the Israel tale again, but giving the human story of the humans the Israelis are, and bringing back the understanding of the remarkable, sometimes tragic, human phenomenon and human endeavor Israel is. As I was about to write a personal story, I had to begin with my own beginning. And my own beginning is in that very same London that I just visited, but in 1897. My great-grandfather, Herbert Bentwich, was a successful London lawyer, a self-made man, quite rough in one way, but very romantic in another way. He was a Victorian gentleman in every way possible. He loved the empire, he loved the queen, he loved Shakespeare, and he loved the theater. London of his day was the capital of the world. His life was the life of privilege. So the question I asked myself is, why would such a Victorian gentleman leave behind London and travel to that remote, desolate province Palestine was? Chaim Weizmann, the great Zionist leader, used to say that you don't have to be crazy to be a Zionist, but it helps. In my great-grandfather's journey that changed the fate of my family, that made me an Israeli rather than some BBC correspondent, that journey seemed to have been crazy. But it was not. Because what I realized as I went into that story is that the early Zionists had two brilliant, tragic insights. At the end of the 19th century, in the 1890s, they realized that Europe is becoming a death trap to its Jews. Now, here is something that should be discussed today, and especially here. As so many people describe Zionism as colonialism, as part of the imperial effort. But the truth is that the Jews were Europe's ultimate other for over a millennium. We were not the masters of the universe. We were the victims of that powerful world. But the early Zionists realized that something worse is about to happen, that we are about to become Europe's ultimate victims. They did not know there will be a Holocaust. They did not know the 20th century will produce such awful places as Auschwitz and Treblinka, gas chambers and trains. But they realized that a new kind of anti-Semitism that is race-based rather than religion-based is changing Europe, and it turns the life of Jews in Europe into a life in jeopardy. So faced with the most radical challenge a people can be faced with, the challenge of extinction, they came up with the most radical solution that people can come up with, and then transferred the Jews from one continent to another and took a land and built a nation and revived the language just to save the Jewish people. And in this sense, the Zionist revolution was one of the most impressive in the 20th century, because it did not only give political or social rights to a people, it actually saved the people physically. And the one sin Zionism has is that it was too late. Because if we had had the Jewish state in 1920s rather than 1948, millions would have been saved. But the early Zionists had another insight, which is more relevant for today. They realized that in the modern era, non-ultra-Orthodox Jewish existence is in jeopardy. Because once anti-Semitism will subside, they realized, once the pogroms will be over and the Cossacks will be gone, we will be faced with exactly the opposite challenge of what happens to us in the nations that accept us and give us rights and liberties and prosperity. So in many ways, the early Zionists saw 100 years ago, over 100 years ago, the challenge facing Jewish communities throughout the diaspora and mainly in this country today. So in the 1890s, they did not only try to preempt the 1940s, they tried to preempt the Pew Report. They tried to preempt the problem facing so many non-ultra-Orthodox Jews today, because they realized that if there is to be a Jewish modern identity and a modern civilization that is not religion-based, it needs a place that will be a powerhouse for that modern Jewish identity. In brackets, one of the reasons I'm so angry at Israeli politics and at the way Israel behaves in the last decade or two is that the fact that extreme religious and extreme nationalist forces in Israel endanger that mission. Because by creating an image that I think is false, that Israel is not what it should be, they drive away young Jews, liberal Jews, away from Israel. And this is a betrayal of Israel's most important mission, which is to guarantee a modern, liberal, democratic Jewish existence in the 21st century and the 22nd century and beyond. But I was not into writing just how great we are. I do think that Israel is remarkable, but I had the duty, the moral and intellectual duty, to tell the story as it is. So I realized that there was a flaw as well. Because when my great-grandfather arrived in Jaffa, he would not see our other. He would not see the fact that Jaffa was a predominantly Arab city, and he would not see the dozens of Palestinian villages along the road from Jaffa to Jerusalem and from Jerusalem to the Lake of Galilee. One has to remember, there was no Palestinian republic there, and there was no Palestinian kingdom. We did not conquer, as some claim, which is totally false, a political entity that was there. The Middle East was in a kind of state of chaos, and the Palestinians did not even define themselves politically as a people. That happened later. And yet, the blindness was there. We were blind to see them, and they were blind to see us. And this mutual blindness created the tragedy of the 100-year-old conflict. So in many ways, if the subtitle of my book is The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel, you have there, in 1897, the seeds of both the triumph and the tragedy. The triumph is the fact that Israel is such a manifestation of the human spirit, of how humans who are endangered and face death rise to the challenge and save themselves and create a nation against all odds. But the tragedy is that from the first moment, the conflict was set in motion. It did not begin with Benjamin Netanyahu walked into his office, and it did not even begin in 1967. It was right there from the beginning, with the mutual blindness of two people who should share a land to see each other and recognize each other. I will not bore you with all the details of the journey I went through in my book. I hope you'll read the book, if there are any of you who have not. But there is one chapter in my book that it is important for me to talk about. People ask me, what have I learned during this journey? I say that mainly what I learned is how miraculous Israel of the 1950s was. I knew about our pioneers, I knew about our wars. I never realized how the young Israel of the 1950s, how impressive it was. Imagine America, God forbid, going through a war in which it loses 3.5 million people. God forbid. And then imagine America in the following 3.5 years absorbing 500 million immigrants. 500 million immigrants. Is that humanly possible? Can it be done by the great, powerful America? I understand that you have some issue with the lower number of immigrants. Israel of the 1950s did that. The civilian heroism of Israel of the 1950s is much more impressive than the pioneer heroism and the war heroism. It did the impossible. But it's not only the numbers. Who are these people Israel absorbed? So many of them were refugees from the Arab world who lost everything overnight. But we did not turn our back on them like the Arab nations turned back on their refugees. With all the problems, that there were many problems in dealing with them, they were given a life. But the other people who came, who were they? Holocaust survivors who had numbers tattooed into their arms, who had nightmares at night, who lost their first wives or husbands and had to start anew with a new family. But these people did not decide to surrender to their tragedy and to their fate. Their revenge was not suicide bombing. Their revenge was to live. and to give their children the best education possible, and to build a health system that is better than yours, and to build housing, and to move on, not to linger over the pain and the victimhood feeling, but to move forward. And this is such an impressive phenomenon. And so much of that spirit is still there in Israel. So I end the book with a journey going in the footsteps of my great-grandfather, looking at my own home from within and from without. And I ask myself, where we have succeeded and where have we failed? What have we achieved and what have we not? On the one hand, what I see when I look at contemporary Israel is an intimidated nation. As you probably know, and you will soon hear, I'm a great opponent of occupation. I think we must end occupation. But I ask all liberals and all peace-loving people to remember there is another component, and the component is intimidation. We have to deal with occupation while we realize there is intimidation. Israel is the only democracy whose existence is in jeopardy, threatened, because of the tension between us and our neighbors for many reasons, because of religious reasons, political reasons, historical reasons. I will not get into all that. But the result is that Israelis are faced with something different. In so many ways, we are another OECD country. We have the high tech, and we have the good life, and we have a consumerist democracy. And yet we are different. Because you in America have many problems. The more I travel around the country, the more I encounter them. But no one in this hall has doubt whether America will be here in 50 years' time or 100 years' time. America might be that, it might be that, more conservative, more liberal. It will definitely change, but it will be here. No Israeli can be certain that Israel will be there in 100 years' time. And this creates the unique Israeli condition and the unique state of mind. We Israelis don't talk about it. It's a taboo because we don't want to surrender to the tragedy. But it's there. And it has impact on everything that we do and how we do it. But if this is the tragedy, the manifestation of the tragedy today, the other side, the bright side, which is so impressive, is that while we live on the edge, we live with a vengeance. Life is so intensive in Israel. So we have turned this special condition into something that does not make us bitter and sad, but vibrant. And you see this wherever you go in Israel. Everybody heard about the Israeli high-tech boom, which is very impressive, but that's only one of the manifestations of this unique vitality. You feel it in commerce, in technology, in science, in theater, in poetry, in cinema, wherever you go. You feel it in the Tel Aviv nightlife. We Israelis, although we are faced with that difficulty, with that unique condition, are innovative and creative and sensual, and many of us are rather sexy. We make more babies than any other OECD country. So what you have in Israel is that on the one hand, we failed to create the utopian socialist society that we were supposed to create. But what we did do is establish one of the most impressive, robust free societies one can imagine. And the phenomena is a phenomena of people who have come from death and are threatened by death, but have chosen life. And Israel is such an astonishing celebration of life on the edge. After I finished writing the book, this terrible, terrible summer has happened. And this summer traumatized all of us. Israel was confronted by Hamas. America was confronted by ISIS. And both happenings traumatized your great democracy and our frontier democracy. So let me talk first about us. Early July, I realized what was about to happen. So I went into the room of my 10-year-old Michael and my 5-year-old Daniel and told them that in the coming days they will hear a sound they never heard before, the howling sound of sirens. 2 days later, the sirens did howl. And as we went down into the basement of our nice suburban home, Michael asked if a missile might hit us and destroy our house, and Daniel asked whether the Iron Dome might be broken. So I looked at my two boys. In so many ways, my boys are just like American boys and girls. They wear the same clothes, they listen to the same music, they disappear in the same iPads. And my boys grew up in one of Israel's most calm decades. We did not have peace this decade, but in central Israel, there was less violence than before. Less Israelis and less Palestinians got killed in the previous years. So my boys grew up in an environment that allowed them to believe, like so many other Israelis, that we actually live in California. But suddenly that was cracked. Suddenly they too were faced with existential threats facing Israel. And it was so sad for me to look at this process, how they too joined the sad Israeli ritual of dealing with that heavy cloud that is hanging over us. What was the war all about? It was the fourth asymmetric war Israel has experienced. But this was somewhat worse than the previous ones because central Israel, Tel Aviv, was hit and because it was so long. The blood of the Tel Aviv people is no thicker than the blood of people living in the frontier. On the contrary, I have more respect to the people living on the frontier. But there is a symbolic and strategic significance to the fact that Israel's commercial and cultural capital was hit day after day. Imagine what would have happened if an Al-Qaeda group would have taken over Guantanamo and would have fired rockets at New York day after day for 50 days. What would have been the implication? And what would have America done even under a peace-loving president? This is what happened. This is the significance of what has happened. Israel dealt with this challenge, with this attack, in a very impressive way on the defensive. Much was said about Iron Dome. I think more must be said. I think that Iron Dome prevented a terrible catastrophe this summer. I would give the engineers of Iron Dome the Nobel Peace Prize. Because if it weren't for them, Israel would have had to conquer Gaza, and hundreds of Israelis would have been killed, and thousands of Palestinians would have been killed. And we would have been faced with a tragedy much worse than the one we did experience. So that was one hero this summer. The other impressive phenomena was the behavior of the Israeli society. We saw some ugly, dangerous phenomena on the fringes of Israeli society that must be condemned. But by and large, Israeli society proved to be resilient, united. But while Israel was so impressive on the defense, Israel found itself without a solution on the offensive to this attack. And the result was the use of this massive firepower in Gaza, No general and no soldier wanted to do that. But because there was no solution, military solution, Israel found itself doing what it did in Gaza. And no one, no decent person, could have looked at the terrible events of the summer without realizing what I wrote about, that there is a terrible, terrible tragedy here that refuses to stop. And this summer was about the tragedy coming back with such fierceness. But while we had our trauma, you had your trauma. Would have anyone thought 5 years ago that we'll see a phenomena as beheading? Beheading on YouTube? Beheading of innocent, good-willing Americans on YouTube with America being helpless? But it's not just the horrific events and the horrific images. Because what's behind these images? 13 years ago, you were attacked. The wild Middle East came crushing into Manhattan and Washington. So the empire struck back, and you launched two wars. But the two wars did not work that well. So people decided to end the wars and come back. And a sense of fatigue developed in this nation. Semi-isolationist thoughts. But what happened this summer? Suddenly you realize that you cannot fix the Middle East, you cannot live with the Middle East, but you cannot run away from the Middle East. What has happened over these 13 years? You went as far as Afghanistan to destroy Al-Qaeda, just to have today Al-Qaeda at Israel's doorstep. You went to Baghdad to impose a Jeffersonian democracy, just to have people now beheading in Iraq. So people are at loss. What do you do with this? The gap between America's values and good intentions and what's happening over there in that wild region is becoming an inherent, dramatic problem. So in many ways, the summer of 2004 ended illusions both in America and Israel. We lived in bubbles, and the bubbles bursted. So we have to ask ourselves, what are we confronted with? What are you confronted with, and what are we confronted with? If you look at the Middle East from an Israeli point of view, but I think from an American point of view as well, you see several challenges. The first one is Iran. Don't let ISIS make you forget Iran. If Iran will go nuclear, our world will change. Iran is a challenge, a nuclear Iran is a challenge to our civilization. One of my criticisms of the Israeli government, that it made it an Israel issue, sometimes personally a Benjamin Netanyahu issue. This should not be the case. A nuclear Iran should disturb any person in the free world, and I think any human. Doesn't matter if you're American, Israeli, European, or Asian. Doesn't matter if you're Democratic or Republican, conservative or liberal. This should not be an issue for some hawks in the Pentagon or the Israeli defense establishment. Because if Iran will go nuclear, the Middle East will go nuclear. And you see what's going on in the Middle East. If you inject nuclear dimension into that chaos, you create a strategic hell. So Tel Aviv will be affected first, but life in America will change too, even in Santa Barbara. This is the greatest challenge facing us, but we failed so far in addressing it, and the Iranians are ahead in the game. The second challenge is, of course, the Arab chaos. I'm an Israeli, but I care about my Arab neighbors. And when I think about Arab young men and women, I ask myself, what are the political options facing them? Only in Tunisia there is some hope. But in the rest of the region, it's an Islamic theocracy, a military dictatorship, a reactionary monarchy, or bloody chaos. We were all so naive 3.5 years ago when we really believed that the Google kids will rule Egypt. And some of my distinguished colleagues compared the Arab Spring to the American Revolution. That's not the case. The Middle East chaos is so troubling. Because what happened in the Middle East, that the old corrupt order based on corrupt tyrannies collapsed, but it was not replaced by a benign order, but by a violent chaos. The third challenge is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I'm a two-state solution guy. I opposed occupation and opposed settlements throughout my adult life. And I wasn't wrong. The international community, liberals in this country, and the left and the peace movement in Israel were totally right in claiming that occupation is unacceptable and settlements are unbearable. In many ways, the status quo is the silent killer endangering Israel from within. It does not only endanger Palestine, it endangers Israel, because it endangers us politically, morally, and demographically. We have to deal with it, and we must change the dynamics. But on the other hand, we have to remember that we tried it. Never in history was a theory about reality tried so many times, tested so many times, like the theory about final status now. We tried it in a different version in Oslo in 93. The result was buses exploding in Tel Aviv. We tried it in 2000 with Ehud Barak and Bill Clinton in their peace summit, heroic peace summit. The result was the worst terror offensive a democracy experienced since World War II. We tried it in 2005 when the right-wing extremist Arik Sharon pulled out of Gaza and dismantled all settlements in Gaza. And the result was a Hamas-controlled territory that fires rockets at Israel. So we have to realize, we peaceniks, we need to be courageous and to see how orthodox peace approach did not work. And we have to realize that in this new chaotic Middle East, it's more difficult, not less difficult. Because even moderate Arabs who want to make peace with Israel don't have enough legitimacy to do it. So we are in a catch. We have to change the dynamics. We have to save the two-state solution. But the old ways of doing it have failed. The fourth challenge in my mind, facing Israel and America and the other side, is the relationship between the West and the Middle East, and specifically between the West and Israel. From the Israeli point of view, our great wisdom in the past was maintaining two principles: a tight, intimate alliance with a great power and an insistence to capture the moral high ground. We always knew that we are a small, lonely people that has morality in its DNA. We are not China, we cannot do Tibet. We are not Russia, we cannot do the Ukraine. We need to do the utmost to try peace even when it's difficult and to be as moral as possible. Sadly, in the last decades, Israel has lost much of its dedication to these principles. And this erosion creates a rift between Israel and larger parts of the West, especially in Europe, but also with progressive forces in this country and with many young people. On the other side of the equation, we've seen the West losing a lot of the wisdom, the realistic wisdom of how to handle the Middle East. The Middle East is a politically incorrect region. As long as you stick to politically correct terms, you don't get it. You just don't get it. You are blind to what really happens. So while Israel has to be more moral, more liberal, more democratic, the West has to be much more realistic and not to try to promote unrealistic concepts. The attempts to bring a Scandinavian peace and the Jeffersonian democracy to the Middle East have failed in a resounding way. It's time to learn from that experience and develop a new approach. So am I pessimistic? It seems all so gloomy. No. I'm a believer. I'm a great believer in Israel. I'm a great believer in Israelis. And, excuse me, I'm a great believer in America and a great believer in Americans. Sometimes I have to remind my American friends how great America is. America gave the world its best period in the last 70 years. And although the world has changed, I do not see any other powers that will lead the world better than America did. But if we want Israel to do the right thing and America to do the right thing, we need new ideas. We need to look at reality in a fresh way. Briefly, here are some suggestions. Regarding Gaza, we must be very firm with Hamas, which is a totalitarian organization, but we must be very generous with the people of Gaza. We cannot ignore 1.8 million people living there. So what is needed is a Marshall Plan that will give billions and billions of dollars for development in Gaza, for building water plants, power stations, housing projects. And long term, we must open up Gaza to northern Sinai. There's vast territory in northern Sinai. If we will bring Saudi money, Egyptian goodwill, Israeli water technology, and international leadership in order to open an economic space for the Gaza people in northern Sinai, we will give them real hope. And then eventually they will get rid of this terrorist, extremist organization that is ruling over them. Regarding Iran, the only way is assertive diplomacy. Assertive diplomacy was tried in 2011 and 2012 under President Obama. He should get every credit for that. And it worked. When the harsh sanctions were imposed and there was determination on the West, the Iranians changed. And the change we see in Iran is a result of that. So we should stick to that kind of assertive diplomacy. So we will reach a deal eventually with the Iranians, but the right kind of deal, and not the dangerous kind of deal that might create a catastrophic reality. Regarding ISIS, this is not for me, but let me give you an friendly advice of a Middle Eastern. The one mistake America must avoid at all costs is to create the impression that there is an American Shiite alliance against the Sunnis. ISIS is dangerous. But if it will be perceived that America is working with Iran and Assad against the Sunnis, the results will be 10 more ISISs. The Sunnis are 85% of the Arab world and the Islamic world. The Sunnis were America's traditional allies. So the only way to fight the Sunni ISIS is to have moderate allies of Sunni allies of America fighting ISIS. If the strategy will be different, you will perhaps solve one issue, but you will create chaos and bitterness and violence for a long time in other parts of the Middle East and in Iran. Regarding the Palestinian issue and the Arab chaos, in my mind, there is a need for a new peace concept. We Israelis must stop settlement activity beyond the blocks. Gradually, we have to consider pulling out of small parts of the West Bank. We cannot do, under the present situation, we cannot withdraw from the entire West Bank because we've learned what has happened. But if we will combine a settlement freeze with gradual moves that gives the Palestinians more space, and if at the same time the Palestinians will go into a process of nation building, and if wherever we withdraw, a Palestinian city is built or a Palestinian industrial zone that gives life to the Palestinians, and if the Saudis and the Gulf states will fund this process and they'll channel some of their money from the Gulf to the West Bank and Gaza, after they funded so many wars, it's time for them to fund a peace. And if America will lead this process, so we will have a kind of America Arab moderates, Israeli moderates, and Palestinian moderates in alliance, working on the real process, not on some theological fantasy. Then we can bring change. Rather than have a futile peace process, let us have peace as a process. Not rather than a final, immediate, formal peace, let's have a gradual, de facto peace that is real, that addresses the reality of the region, but sees the opportunities within this new chaotic situation. And yet, we need the deeper, deeper change that I referred to before. At the end of the day, Israel must go back to its benign self. Israel cannot go on surrendering to the dark forces within it. It has to deal with occupation. It has to prove day in and day out that it's a real liberal democracy. And it must prove that it really has shared values with America. At the same time, America, as I said, has to find a new realistic way to lead the Middle East and lead the world. There is no alternative. There is no alternative. It's a small, globalized world. And there is no hiding from extremism, from fundamentalism, from this kind of violence. The Middle East today is a very dangerous region. It is spiraling out of control. But the most important city in the Middle East is Washington. Only if in America we will see the emergence of a new realistic thinking, and only if Israel will go back to its benign nature, then the alliance between your great democracy and our frontier democracy will be the alliance that it should be and it must be. And only together will be able to deal with the terrible challenges facing us in the coming decade in the Middle East. Thank you very much.
That was quite amazing. And while the questions are being collected, I want to pose a question to you based on your optimistic conclusion when you outlined what you call your peace concept. Earlier today, I said your peace plan. You properly corrected me. But what about the city of Jerusalem? In your peace concept, as you look at it, what will happen to the city, or what might happen to the city?
My claim, as you can imagine, I have no ideological problem making concessions in Jerusalem. It'll be painful, but I don't have a doubt for a minute. Peace is definitely worth any concession. That is not a suicidal concession. So, although I'm deeply attached to Jerusalem, but I'm willing to make any compromises needed that will bring about a real, stable, sustainable peace. The problem is that touching Jerusalem right now will just create more friction, more instability. In order to solve, at the end of the process, Jerusalem, we need to be so mature. The Palestinians have to be so mature. The Israelis have to be so mature. You need something that I don't know if the Swiss have right now. I mean, you need to completely political, a different political culture to deal with it, because Jerusalem is so small, so sensitive. So my suggestion, not to deal with this issue now. On the one hand, I do not think that Israel should build in a provocative way within Arab neighborhoods and Arab quarters. That will contribute to have lesser tensions. On the other hand, I think that the Palestinians who really want to move forward can understand that there is no way to do it now. So Jerusalem has to be the symbolic and wonderful end of a long peace process. If we'll try to solve it in the beginning, the result will be what we saw in 2000. We touched Jerusalem in a kind of courageous way, and the result was horrific violence. And what troubles me more today is that we see that Gaza that I described moved to Jerusalem, because you see a kind of holy war developing around the holy city. So the first imperative now is to cool it. Let's not have any Israeli provocations. Let's not have Palestinian provocations. Let's try to have kind of reasonable, practical compromises on the ground, but leave the great issue of how we divide and share Jerusalem in a benign way to the years to come.
Let me begin by asking a very provocative question.
That's what we are for.
That provocative question is, and I'll read it, you speak as if the opposition Israel is facing from Palestine is completely unwarranted. How else do you expect a region to respond to the systematic destruction of its people's way of life? Are people supposed to remain peaceful after being oppressed and sent into exile?
Well, I don't know who asked the question, but I suggest that whoever asked the question would read my book. I don't think that anyone who reads my book can say that I don't have empathy, deep empathy, to the tragedy, to the Palestinian suffering and to the Palestinian tragedy. I can tell you that not a day passes that I'm not aware of what has happened to the Palestinians in the past and the suffering so many Palestinians go through today. So I'm totally into understanding that. But I do not think that, on the other hand, people should be forgiving for any outrageous acts that people do just because they happen to be Palestinians. Look, if you are into the victimhood game, no one can beat the Jews in the victimhood game. So let's not go that way. I mean, let's not compete who suffered most. Obviously, the Palestinians suffered and are suffering, and obviously I'm saying that we must address that. But we should not, on the other hand, treat the Palestinians as if they are not moral agents themselves. I think that there is too much acceptance of the way that Palestinian individuals are treated by Palestinians. I'm not only concerned about what Hamas is doing to my people. I'm concerned about what Hamas is doing to Palestinians, to Palestinian women, to Palestinian gays, to Palestinian Christians, to Palestinian individuals. So the way to deal with the conflict and with this terrible, tragic complexity is to demand of Israel to do the right things, but at the same time not to be totally forgiving for any Palestinian act just because of the tragedy the Palestinians have experienced. And I think that only a kind of balanced approach like that can really take us from this terrible situation that we are in into some sort of more reasonable future.
You know, there are so many interesting questions. I'm covering my pants with them here, but, I wish we had the whole night with you. But here's a different kind of question. We'll come back to the Israel and the Palestinians. Okay. But why hasn't your book been translated into Hebrew? And how do Israelis respond? Has it made the same impact on Israelis as American Jews?
I think there is a slight contradiction in the question. I mean, how could the Israelis have responded if it's not in Hebrew? The book, this is one of these deep questions that have a shallow answer. My book was not translated, was not published yet in Hebrew because I've written it twice. I've written it in English and in Hebrew. And the original idea was that I'll come to this country for a month-long book tour and then go to Israel and edit the Hebrew version, because the editing was done with Random House on the English version. And what happened is that since the book came out, I didn't have a quiet day, definitely not 2 months. So hopefully if I catch my plane tonight, which begins my way back to Israel, and I'll arrive in Israel in 10 days' time, hopefully I will find the time to do the editing of the Hebrew, so the book will come out within a few months in Hebrew.
Okay. You know, I wish that we could keep Ari Shavit with us for the rest of the night. Don't you? Don't you agree? And there are so many more questions that are very, very interesting, but unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time with you. Our friends at the Book Den have copies of My Promised Land, The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel, that you can purchase. And Ari will be here to sign copies of his book if you would like. Of course, we're getting close to the holiday season, and this might be a wonderful, wonderful book to give someone that you find to be very important in your life. It's an important book, and we feel so privileged that you've been with us for the last 2 days. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.